6. Demonstrate your game. The January frost had turned a light drizzle into a thin spiral of white flakes outside the demolition building at 9 in the evening, when Lai Chun touched Martha Einkorn's gold-edged keycard to the black panel in the glass elevator. The screen read, Floor 70. Chun hadn't even known there was a 70th floor of guest rooms in this hotel. The doors closed silently, and the hotel lobby fell away. Beneath Chun's feet were the stalls and miniature stages of this smaller part of the conference. Even at this point, there were still late-night sessions, a fireside chat with a psychologist with brushed blonde hair, sitting in an armchair talking about survivor guilt, a man in a flannel shirt giving a presentation on how to talk to your kids about survival. Through the sliding wall at the far end of the hall, Chun could see part of the expo, a forest of stalls and, towering over them, a great fiberglass mountain with snowy peaks advertising some brand of all-weather gear. The mountain was visible from every point in the expo. In the evenings, it was lit from within to simulate a sunset, yellow and pink and gold. As it dwindled, as Chun rose in the elevator, it felt for a moment that all this was leaving her, not that she was moving at all. On the 70th floor, the doors of the elevator opened not onto a featureless corridor, but onto a palace, bookcases filled with books, a long lacquered dining table, 3 leather sofas, a blue tiled floor like a wave washing toward the view out the window 70 stories up.
"Fuck me," said Chun. "God, she's a bit bloody direct, isn't she?" said a woman lying on one of the sofas, half concealed from view.
She leaned up on her elbows and looked at Chun with curiosity, interest, and humor. Chun thought, "Shit, I know who that is."
"Oh, you're on time," said Martha Einkorn. "That's good. Selenomic, meet Lai Chun. She has an amazing channel about survival. Surly Survivor. Champagne?"
Chun looked at Martha, at her belly roll outline in her jumpsuit, at the gold nose stud, and thought, "I don't care if it's one night. I will. I absolutely will." And then she wanted very badly indeed not to screw this up.
"Don't mind if I do," said Sella, taking a flute of champagne.
Chun thought, "Remember this taste. This is probably the good stuff." Sella flicked her eyes between Martha and Chun, seemed about to say something, and then changed her mind.
"So, you've got a channel about survival. I think I've seen it, actually. You did the thing with the scorpion tank."
"No, that was Professor Blast. I did..."
"Got it. You did Living in a Tree for a week."
"I did. My husband loved that one. Incredible."
"I'm a coder," said Sella.
"Well, I was. I mostly give money away now, so I'm utterly useless in an apocalypse scenario."
Were they going to pretend Chun didn't know who she was? Who her husband was? She had been a genuinely exceptional hotshot coder. She'd written part of the script for Anvil's logistics and delivery systems, making them super efficient and reliable. She was married to the richest man on the planet, a man who was relentless in pursuit of efficiency, who had reinvented how haulage and then delivery and then the world's infrastructure worked. But maybe that was what very rich, very famous people liked, if you just pretended you hadn't read anything about them.
"Coding's not useless in the apocalypse. We'd probably need someone to hack ex-Soviet nuclear plants and shut them down safely. Do you think you could do that?"
"Me?"
Sella puffed at one cheek, thinking.
"I could give it a bloody good go, yeah. I speak a bit of Russian.
We could probably find a translator."
"We?" said Sella. "Are you running the global consortium of apocalypse survivors in this scenario?"
"Right, then. Go big or go home."
"Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do it, but I'd rather I did it than anyone else."
Sella barked out a laugh.
"I see why you like her. All right. You hungry? I'm starving. Let's get some dinner."
Later,
Although she'd told herself she'd tried to remember every moment, Chun couldn't really recall a great deal of the conversation over dinner. This was partly because she'd drunk quite a lot of the deceptively soda-like champagne, but mostly because Martha Einkorn had a way of smiling, where a tiny peep of pink tongue licked the very center of her curved top lip. And because when Chun tentatively brushed the tips of her fingers along Martha's thigh under the table, this apparently fairly wealthy and powerful woman did not move away. In fact, she touched the top of Chun's hand lightly with her own fingers. Who could be expected to remember a conversation in circumstances like those? The only part she really remembered was about the inevitable arrival of the apocalypse. Sela Nomek had leaned across the table and said, "So, you're an expert. What's your survival plan in the event of bug invasion, Chun?" "Bug invasion? Like giant mutant bugs or killer bacteria?" "Either. Both." "You serious?" Chun looked quizzically at Martha, whose fingertips were even now lightly stroking the fine hairs on Chun's forearm. Chun was a mess of desire. "Dead serious," Martha grinned. "Maybe you wouldn't really survive a bug invasion. Maybe you've got no game." "Oh, I've got game." "So demonstrate your game," said Sela. Chun moved her arm away from Martha under the table. Thinking and sex were not parallel process activities. "Okay, so both giant bugs and bacteria together would be problematic, because the strategies that'll keep you alive in the event of a sudden macro predator, which, by the way, that's not going to happen, that's a sci-fi movie, would involve working in huge packs with any humans left. But if there's a killer infection, your best idea is to separate off as quickly as possible into a small, self-contained group." "How would you do that?" Sela said. "Seriously?" Chun said. Sela tipped her glass and raised an eyebrow. "All right, first, get out of the city, obviously," said Chun. "Obviously," said Martha, as if she knew a secret. "Bunkers aren't great. Too many people. I'd go deep woods, or an island if I could get to an island." "An island," Sela said. "Interesting." "Yeah, but a lot of people will be trying that. It'd need to be uncomfortable living. A good tent, set traps, hunt with a crossbow, prepare to lose some weight. A small community. Just a few people who really have each other's backs. Not going it alone. Individualism is a fool's game in this scenario. You cut yourself and get an infection, there's no one to scavenge antibiotics, you die. You fall down a ravine, there's no one to find you, you die. You're not worried about infighting. Try to mitigate it, focus on the future. What about if you had a ton of money and you could pay soldiers to look after you? I mean, how quickly does your bug kill people?" Martha exchanged a look with Sela and wrinkled her nose. 17-day incubation. You're infectious the whole time. Then a 5-day illness. Then 50% of people die." "Oh, wow, okay. That's good. I mean, that's terrible. Look, soldiers are no use in that scenario. Money rapidly ceases to have value. And then what have you got to offer them? You're just a body taking up resources. Even if you have the code to the food stores or something, they lock you up and torture you until you give it to them." "Shit. Right." Martha poured more wine. It was golden and sweet, but not too sweet. It tasted like money. It was getting late. Had Martha Einkorn really invited Chun to dinner with Sela Nomek and felt Chun up under the table so they could all talk? "So," said Sela, with the air of someone making a serious proposition, "if you knew the end of the world was coming, and that you could get away, if you had the golden ticket that would keep you safe, would you take it?" Chun looked between the women. There was a meaning to this conversation, something she wasn't party to. "Is this a trick question?" "No," said Martha. "It's not a trick question. It's a moral question. You'll live and be fine, but everyone else will have to suffer through that plague. Would you take the golden ticket out?" Obviously, yes. I live for survival. Even if you knew everyone you loved was going to die horribly? Even if you knew taking it meant that you could never tell them what you had? I can't share it? Most survival plans work better with a solid group. Not this one. The more people know, the less good it is, said Martha. Sella gave a small, almost imperceptible shake of the head. Is that why you're both here? And Lank Sketlish and Zimri Nomik? Because there's a golden ticket? Sella said, What makes you think Lank and Zimri are here? Just because I don't get invited to the demonstration on the roof terrace doesn't mean I don't know what's going on. Jun shifted a shoulder. I talk to catering staff. It's not hard. She talks to catering staff, said Sella. That's how you find things out, said Martha. Jun was nicely drunk by this point, but not so drunk as she seemed. Something was going on here. The same instinct that told her when she needed to get out of a situation also told her where there was a story. Something here was bigger even than a show-off drone weather demonstration. Her mind riffled through a set of possibilities. Anything she'd heard of here that might be big enough for Lank Sketlish, Zimri Nomik, and, now she thought of it, Ellen Bywater to come in person to see or have pitched or buy. She blinked, thinking. And just then, Martha's hand brushed the very top of her thigh by the groin. Oh, just a second. I just need to go to the restroom, she heard herself saying, and stood up. In the bathroom, Jun felt the slipperiness between her legs. There was a moment, there's always a moment, of wondering whether to just leave. Something was going on here that was far above her level. And very possibly, she was going to have a wild sex time with one, possibly two, rich and powerful women. And while her vagina was voting yes, the rest of her had lived through a refugee camp and a forced relocation. So she always stopped, considered her options. She texted Marius. Never let a billionaire move you to a second location. At least, not without letting someone know. Jun. Martha Einkorn and Sella Nomik. Know anything about them? Marius.
Only what everyone knows. You doing a story?
Jun. Having dinner with them. They're together. Why are they together? Also, M.E. has her hand on my thigh? Marius.
They want you for good publicity. Some story is coming. They want you to spin it for them.
Jun. You're such a cynic. Marius.
You didn't want cynic. You didn't text me.
Marius.
Maybe you pissed them off and they want to bury you in deep grave in quiet woods.
Jun. Maybe they like me. Marius.
Yes, yes, maybe they want to marry you. Don't send me invitation. I hate weddings.
Well, that was Marius. Former Soviet bloc for life. She texted him the details of the room and a photo just in case she vanished without a trace, and he replied,
Tell me if they try to kill you.
Sitting on the toilet, Jun allowed herself about 45 seconds of daydreaming about what kind of wedding Martha Einkorn would arrange. Probably in a castle of some sort. But she didn't go on long because she'd messed up relationships and herself before by imagining the future after the first date. Her therapist had explained that human beings long for certainty so much that we're willing to even undermine and sabotage ourselves in the search for it. Worrying about whether you'll get a second date? The easiest way to end your uncertainty is to be so weird and creepy with her that you definitely won't get a second date. The urge to imagine the winter wedding is an urge to make it all crash and burn so you don't have to think about it anymore. Looking for a distraction, she scrolled her feeds. Miami's flood defenses had failed again, and 38,000 people's homes were underwater in the most literal sense. Another storm was heading for Bangladesh. Estimates were that more than 13,000 people would die in the next 48 hours. For the fourth year, the Colorado River had failed to refill over the winter. There were calls to rename it the Colorado Gully. a brief report on demolition. The apocalypse industry was thriving. It was still boom times for the end times.
Okay, at least that was distracting. The normal apocalypse and disaster in the normal way.
She'd been in here about 4 minutes. She could probably go to 6 minutes before it seemed weird. She checked her mentions. This was a mistake, because her mentions were a car crash. Several hundred people calling her stupid, ignorant, a cocksucker, not even a cocksucker, anti-American, not that she was really truly American, and the usual flotsam of people using epithets for Asian, epithets for lesbian, epithets for woman. A flood of adrenaline crashed through her body. Every possible fear happening all at once. The border guards telling her father they couldn't come through. Shots in the dark and the scent of burning kerosene while she shivered under her cot. Her girlfriend telling her she'd been having an affair. Her work turning out to be a terrible pile of crap. The moment of the explosion. The thing with the dog. All of it, as if it were happening immediately right now. What the hell had happened? Her mind was searching through her worst deeds to see whether she could have done anything to deserve this. She clicked through the mentions, looking for the source. There it was, a 3-second video of her saying, "Didn't Enoch go mental on the subway? Didn't he threaten people and steal their wallets?" And then a lot of anger. A brief search confirmed that, yes, in fact, the Enochite community online was still fairly active. Enoch had considered himself a direct spiritual descendant of Abraham. The Enochite belief system centered on a theory called pieces, which said that the world was descending into fragmentation. Online, they talked about entering the Babel to save souls from pieces, and there was some stuff about foxes and rabbits that Shun didn't understand, except that it seemed to be saying we all ought to leave our houses and go back to hunting and gathering, which none of them had actually done. The internet these days was full of so many subgroups and disparate voices that it was impossible to keep up with all of them. These guys weren't her guys. They were survivalist adjacent, but not her brand of tech survivalism. No one in her core audience would give a crap if some fundamentalists thought she was anti-religion. This was, in essence, unpleasant, but not an actual problem. She turned her notifications off. Jun walked out of the bathroom, full of adrenaline, realizing that she'd been in the toilet for approximately 12 minutes, which was too long, and now it'd seem like she had some kind of terrible, unattractive stomach problem. She only realized precisely at this moment that the urge to check her notifications had also been an urge toward self-sabotage, which was also the urge toward certainty. Shit, her brain was a sneaky bastard. She was wondering what to say and whether to ask Martha about the Enochite situation when she heard the two women in the dining room whispering quietly to each other. And because this is how you survive, Jun slowed down and listened. Selenomic said, "Zimri's expecting me back soon. Your girl's sharp. You haven't mentioned our friend the Prophet to her at all." Martha said, "No. She might be useful. This is not for that."
"Everything's for that. Some things are going to have to be put off, okay?"
Jun stepped around the side of the bookcase. Who put a bookcase full of books in a hotel room? Just as Selenomic smiled, stood up and said,
"Right, I've got to be off. Great to meet you, Jun. Be seeing you."
And Jun smiled, shook her hand, thought, "Prophet? Did she mean Enoch?" And then she and Martha Einkorn were alone, and all she wanted was to know whether this moment, full of promise, was the thing that was going to have to be put off. Martha stood by the window, looking at the view. London twinkling and dark, the Thames barriers raised again, the river full and deep. The snow falling thicker now, not quite melting, dusting the pavement with white. The buildings by the water's edge, their facades of stone carved into curlicues and made to look like folded fabric, were protected by 6 layers of strengthened perspex screens now, to keep them safe when the tides rose. The stories of imperial power the marble had been created to tell were long over. Now the lights and the flood defenses told a different tale. The water was coming, and London, like everywhere, would have to choose what to protect. Martha beckoned her over, and they stood together watching the whirring lights of the drone doves darting between the buildings, the softly plashing water. From here, it looked like it would be all right when it happened. Even beautiful. Even magnificent. Goosebumps rose on Shun's arms. This moment. The moment before you touch. When you want to. When all you have is guessing that the other person wants to as well. The gap between two bodies almost unbridgeable. Martha said, "So, how come you're single?"
"I was in a long thing with my college girlfriend. She cheated. We broke up."
Sucks. She broke your heart."
"Yeah," said Shun.
"You still miss her?"
"I liked the idea that we might end up staying together forever. It felt, you know, neat, elegant, spare."
Martha touched Chun's bare arm, just brushing her fingertips over the skin. Chun pulled away slightly, aching. Martha hesitated. Chun said,
"How did you meet her? Selenomic?"
"We have some stuff in common."
"Look," said Chun, "I'm okay with whatever the answer to this is, really. I mean, people do what they do, and I'll keep your secret. Cheating is a thing adults do, and other people's relationships aren't always obvious. I just need to know for I don't cheat reasons, okay? I have casual sex if everyone knows the score, but I don't cheat. Are you and Selenomic together?"
Martha laughed. It was so obviously a real laugh, impossible to take it for anything else. Martha shook her head.
"Sadly, Selenomic is totally 100% straight."
Shen laughed too, and then they were silent. It was the serious, almost grave silence that comes just before the opening to one another. Opening is dangerous, every single time. But that's how we are here. Martha ran her hand across Shen's shoulders.
"You want this?"
Shen said, "I do."
Martha's hand was sliding down her back toward her ass, and Shun was so turned on she could barely breathe.
"It's all signals," said Martha, "sending and receiving signs, hoping we interpreted them right. Meeting, flirting, fucking."
Shun brushed the fingertips of her left hand against the side of Martha's neck. Martha sighed softly. Shun's groin was heavy and aching.
"Yeah," she said.
"There's no way to tell unless we make ourselves vulnerable."
Martha tipped her head to the side, looked at Shun, and gave that halfway smile. Shun leaned in and kissed her. And one thing went on to another. There was, in total, 3.5 days of fucking. Just enough for it to be achingly, terrifyingly obvious that they ought to fuck a lot more. A lot more. And for Jun to think, this would be okay. I could quit all the apocalypse traveling. I could follow her around. I could be home somewhere when she's home. I could figure this out. And for her to think, enough, stop, just let this be what it is for now. But she had never been able to do that. She ran her tongue along one of the pale, silvery smooth stretch marks ribbing the skin of Martha's shoulder like mackerel stripes. Between Shun's conference talks, between Martha's meetings, between ordering room service dinner, Shun asked Martha questions about Lenk, about Zimri Nomic, about previous girlfriends, and Martha Einkorn answered almost none of them.
"I just want you to know," said Shun, "that if you're holding out on me because of, like, erotic mystique, I'm already
extremely into you. And Martha laughed, and they started again. Because it was going to be nothing, Chun told herself. It was going to be a story she'd tell her next actual girlfriend. Just keep believing you can control the future. That you know what's coming. And what's coming is nothing good. At the end of the third day, just after 3 a.m., Chun woke to the sound of Martha scribbling a note and pulling her boots on. The sound was soft, and she had a diffuse MIDI light shining from her thin screen, just enough to see by. Chun kept her breathing even. Martha touched her shoulder, and she sighed and rolled over, thinking all the time, where the fuck are you going at 3 a.m.? Martha summoned the elevator, which arrived with an almost silent shh of the doors. As soon as the doors closed, Chun was up, pulling on her jeans and t-shirt. She called the elevator back, and yes, through the glass tube, she could just see which direction Martha was walking, back toward the conference venue. She didn't even know why she was following her, but there was something here. She knew it. All her instincts told her something was happening. Chun ran across the darkened hotel lobby as fast as she could, bare feet on green tile. The chairs at the restaurant were piled on tables. One sleepy security guy at the side door didn't see her pass by. She kept to the shadows and headed toward the expo hall. The main door should have been shut, but it wasn't. It was wedged open a fraction by a credit card-sized triangle of black plastic. Just enough to hold it, not enough to attract attention. Chun pulled the door toward her and slipped through. In the dark, it was hard to orient herself. The floating survival blimp was to the, she squinted, yes, to the west of the hall. That meant weapons was to her right, medical to her left. Ahead, in making fire, there was a small, soft light, and people talking in low voices. Keeping behind cover of the expo panels, Chun crept toward the light. She passed racks of self-loading and self-cleaning rifles, rifles with smart sights, a visor that would tell you which of the animals and plants you were looking at were actually edible, home defense systems with automated firing patterns for defending your home against foxes, which everyone knew meant defending your home against people of color. She was getting closer to the talking, to the lights that were converging from several different directions at once. She rounded a display of portable hides and cover, and suddenly across the aisle from her were two people, carrying a single diffuse light between them. Chun ducked back into shadow, but she needn't have worried. They were too wrapped up in their own conversation to notice her. It was Selenomic, and it was Zimri actual Nomic. Sela said, "Don't shit where you eat, Zimri. She's my fucking massage therapist. You utter git." Zimri said, "I'm not getting into details, okay? I'm not getting involved with these semantics." And they were past her, walking toward the other glowing lights. She followed, keeping tight to the darkest spots. The other lights were waiting for Sela and Zimri. Martha was there. The globe of light illuminating her face from underneath turned her softness into a kind of radiance. She had paper files with her. Had to be something too secret to put on the cloud and send via email. She stood with Ellen Bywater and Lank Skellish. What the shit was going on here? These people met all the time, didn't they? Presidential forums and press conferences. They had houses and private islands. What could make them meet in the middle of the night in a deserted expo hall? They were at the base of the mountain, Chun realized. The fiberglass construction with snowy peaks. Ellen said, "Are they in there?" Martha nodded. "Just the one making the sale." "Well, how much do they want?" said Zimri. "They haven't shown it works yet. There hasn't been a live test." Sela said, "We're just here to listen, Zimri." Lank said, "There'll be an opportunity for a live test." They all looked ordinary close up. Ordinary, but rich, with all the things rich people had. Good skin, good teeth, bodies cared for by personal trainers and personal chefs, clothes that were crisp even when they were soft, like the artist had used a really sharp pencil in drawing their lines. They weren't beautiful people. Even Lenk, the most theoretically good-looking of them, had a dissatisfied quality that made him almost ugly. But they were rich, and their money had outlined them with precision and neatness. Ellen Bywater reviewed her briefing pack and muttered under her breath. Zimri Nomik shrugged and barely took his eyes from the screen of his anvil tab. Lenk Sketlish looked around the silent, empty concourse as if hunting for something. Chun ducked away from his gaze. He was looking at her. She was certain he was going to point to say, "There is a spy." But he broke away suddenly and said, "It's time." There was a crack in the world, and the crack was light. A door opened behind them, a blast of photons as loud as an explosion.
"Come in," said a male voice from within the mountain. "I'm C. Packship, and I'm here to ask you one important question. How do you know when to go? Because by the time you know the world's ending, it's already too late."
"For fuck's sake," said Zimri. "We're not even inside yet."
"I'm so sorry," said Martha. "Mr. Packship doesn't want to waste any of your valuable time." Martha looked out into the dark for a moment, and then closed the mountain, and Chun was left outside. Chun waited for a couple of hours, but no one came out, and she could hear nothing even though she put her ear to the mountain and listened. She tried to feel for the crack of the door, but the thing was so perfectly constructed, all rough edges and crags, that you'd never have known there was an opening if you hadn't seen it. Eventually, she found somewhere to rest, somewhere she could observe them when they came out. But at 7 a.m., she woke with the rising sun in the ultralight hammock strung between two girders and had to sneak around the back of several exhibits to avoid awkward questions from the early morning arrivals, already letting themselves into the expo hall with hot coffee and high hopes. Jun went back to Martha's suite. There was a note waiting for her on the bedside table on thick cream paper in blue fountain pen strokes, the note Martha had been writing when Jun woke. "Had to head off. I've given you a little gift. Your sort of thing. I think you'll get a kick out of it. This way, you have to see me again. XXM. P.S. Special Wi-Fi for this floor." There was a login for the internet etched into a thin steel card. There was no gift, though. No little box, no book, not even a text message. There was the hotel room, paid for until tomorrow, even though Martha had gone and the concierge didn't know where. Jun logged on and paid some bills, sent some emails, watched some of the new crash pad. She saw that the social media storm about Enochites was growing. Someone had put up a video of the whole interview with Martha, and because this was the way the internet rushed to leave out the middle of a story, instead of being fascinated that Lenk Sketlish's PA had been part of a religious cult, conservatives had decided that Lai Chun was deliberately trying to humiliate a woman who'd suffered for her beliefs. There was a small but worrying crossover between this group and white supremacists, and some AI-generated images were now circulating of Chun being mauled by bears with dicks for eyes due to a complex internet joke she'd once understood. And, naturally, there was a second group of left-wing people who felt that using a queer woman of color in this way was dumb, prejudiced, and racist in itself, and who were responding with images of the eye-dick bears having their brains blown out. The internet of Medlar and Fantail and Anvil was designed to cut away the middle. There were no clicks or eyeballs in the sensible, reasoned middle ground, and all the money in the world in encouraging users to rush to treat the extremes as if they were the center. Chun spent more than an hour typing up a statement. She regretted her mistake about Enoch. She understood why people felt angry. She wouldn't do it that way again. Not enough to calm down anyone who was determined to be furious, but whatever would be. Truthful, which had to be enough. She locked herself out of the accounts where most of the abuse was being hurled at her, changed her passwords, and sent the new randomized ones to Marius. She'd been here before. Do a sensible statement, and then just don't look for a while. It'll die down. She needed to go and do some shit in the real world for a while. In the circumstances, it was understandable that Chun had heard the word prophet, thought about it for a moment, and then almost instantly forgotten it. That it had taken her months to remember that another name for a prophet is an augur.